Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Happy St. Patrick's Day from sunny Napa Valley. Ilona Thompson here with Palate Exposure. I am here at Kitchen Collective with Ralph Hedelandi, who is the founder, vintner of Hedelandi Vineyards. And we're going to find out from a man that's dressed very appropriately. He's wearing every St. Patrick Day accessory I can think of, and sipping Chablis in front of me, very debonair, very European. We're going to find out all his secrets today, and we're going to start with his background. We're going to talk about where he came from and why. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.
So, should I just start off talking?
You should just tell me everything. Where were you born?
My whole life story.
Your whole life story. No, we're going to go deep today.
So. All right. Well, I was conceived in... No, I'm kidding. I was born in Berkeley, California.
All right.
My mom, let's start off with my dad. Hedelandi, yeah. My last name is Hungarian.
Uh-huh.
My dad was born in Budapest, and he caught the last boat out of Europe during World War II.
Wow.
June of 1940, he was actually in Paris 2 days before Hitler took it over, and that was the day that he fled out of France. Because my grandfather was a diplomat for the Hungarian post in Paris. So it was a very tumultuous time, as everyone knows. A German submarine almost sunk their boat but they looted it instead. The captain of the boat said, we're in neutral waters. And at that point in the war, 1940, he said, the captain said, if you sink this boat, America's going to get involved. And
wow.
So that's the only reason they let them go. Otherwise, that submarine would have sunk it. Meanwhile, fast forward about 10 years from that point. So my dad grew up on the East Coast, and my grandmother on that side was from Washington, D.C., so it all kind of made sense there. Meanwhile, my mom was born in China and raised in Peru because of the communists in China, and they both met each other at UC Berkeley.
My goodness.
So my mom was getting her undergrad while my dad was getting his PhD, and that's where they met. The rest is history, and they're always into wine, but they didn't really raise me into the industry at all. They just consumed it. Excuse me.
We have some source of noise that showed up, but it's all good. It's fixed, so yes. What a background, by the way. I mean, I can't wait to hear about what it's like growing up in a family that had so many cultural influences.
Yeah, so my ancestors have actually been making wines for the last 300 years, since the 1700s in the old world, specifically the Lake Balaton region of Hungary, which is the only only volcanic region of Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And when I bought my little vineyard on the slopes of Hell Mountain, I had no idea that I gravitated towards that terroir because of my DNA. So, because I didn't put two and two together. My ancestors have been producing Sirke Barat, which is Pinot Gris, and Kekniellu, which is only produced in that region of the world. It's not a hermaphrodite, it does not self-pollinate, so you need a male row and a female row to cross-pollinate. It takes up twice as much to produce half the yield. So most people just rip it out, put in something like a Riesling or a hermaphrodite type of, vinifera type of.
So hold up a second. You said this in perfect accent. Do you actually speak Hungarian?
No, I speak kitchen Chinese and wine Hungarian. I know the basics. I speak five languages, but...
He says casually.
My dad, he, even though Hungarian was his first language, because he fled the fascists in the 40s, he did not retain a lot of his Hungarian. So I know the basics, but I was talking to another Hungarian winemaker, and he told me recently, you really have to work on your accent. So I'm like, oh, man.
Well, to my ears, it was like, you know, it was very seamless, and I could never repeat what you said. But I understand that those are the varieties that you must have gotten to know well, because there's some synergy between what you, you know, currently doing.
Well, everyone knows Tokaj.
Right.
But no one really knows the dry wines of Hungary. And there's a lot of amazing varietals being produced out there that really deserve worldwide recognition. And I think a lot of sommeliers are getting turned on to that nowadays. And also Georgian wines. I bought a few bottles of Georgian wine recently that monks produce, and they use beeswax to seal it up. I can't even pronounce the name of it, but I discovered it from Ian Cobble's website. And so I took a chance on it, and I'm saving it for something special with other wine geeks like myself who can truly appreciate that, because I'm not going to just casually open it up.
No, that makes sense. So there's no wine conversations at dinner table in your family, is that correct?
Well, my parents drank a lot of French wines growing up.
Okay.
So in the 80s, I remember I tasted a French Bordeaux for the first time when I was around 5 years old. I remember this story because my parents told it so many times afterwards, but they had a dinner party and they would not let me drink what they were drinking, but they were all drinking it. And me being the baby in the family, out of three kids, I'm the baby. I was always doing the exact opposite of what they told me to do. I was kind of the rebel child. So I remember them telling me the story of how they once the party ended, they found me under the table with clearly having drank the wine that was above the table. So I remember they were telling me that I wouldn't like it, and I remembered liking it. Well, I must have if I drank it all. So it's kind of been in my blood ever since. When I was 15, I started making beer, and I thought that was a pretty cool thing to do. My parents thought otherwise, and they shipped me off to boarding school on the East Coast. I've just kind of been that rebellious guy, and whenever there's a rule, I tend to want to break it, just because I never was really good at following rules, and perhaps that's why I've gotten to where I've gotten to today, because I don't just follow the status quo. I always love pushing envelopes and seeing how far I can take something, especially whether it's branding, labeling. My labels, for instance, it took me a year and a half to produce that label with my graphic design team, who is absolutely wonderful. They're on my speed dial still are on my speed dial, but they're on my speed dial, and I would call them every day, and I'd be incredibly demanding. I would tell them what I want, and they would execute, and I'd be like, no, that's not good enough, let's keep going. And so that's how all of my projects have been. Every single varietal I produce has a different theme of my family coat of arms, my Hungarian coat of arms.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them I did in a Leonardo da Vinci style, my Chardonnay, where I created my own da Vinci code on the label where you can decipher it yourself. And the key is on the capsule. So it's funny because Leonardo da Vinci was left-handed, and he wrote his journals backwards because he didn't want his hand to smear. So he would write his journals in Latin backwards. And I basically created my own code in a gold foil in the background. And since the key is on the capsule, it's Hertelendi spelled backwards on the capsule. And to this day, I haven't told my capsule company why it's backwards. And they are just as OCD as I am. And they're like, we can flip this around for you, because it bothers them so much that they're printing something backwards. They're like, you do understand it's backwards. I'm like, yeah, just go ahead and print it. It's fine. And they're like, this guy, they must have been like the biggest idiot in the world printing a backwards capsule. But
why was that important to you? Why did you go through such length?
I love throwing Easter eggs into my projects. So things that you will discover on your own after you acquire a bottle or two of my wines, I get the best emails where people who know nothing about the Easter eggs, they discover it on their own, and they're like, was this intentional? Was this deliberate? And for instance, they're like, I got this one email not too long ago where this gentleman said, I have your wines in my cellar, and when I turned off the lights in my cellar, your labels illuminated my exit. Are you aware that your labels glow in the dark? And I said, oh, really? Do they? Oh, thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Apparently, wine matches with homework. You know, a lot of people are of the school of thought that you simplify so that for the consumer that has, you know, a very small amount of time, sometimes it's seconds, to make a buying decision, that the label should be very clear and very obvious. You took an absolute opposite, and it works, huh?
It's true. It's all about the details to me. I love focusing on the smallest of details so much. It is very obsessive, actually. And for instance, the border of my Cabernet label took me 6 months. Just the border alone took me 6 months to produce because it is so interlaced. I had an illustrator working on it. I went to the Louvre, I went to Versailles, I took about 60 pictures of my favorite motifs, elegant motifs on the walls or painting frames or just the trim on the walls in Versailles. Everything's just very ornate and very luxurious looking. I took two out of my favorite 60. Actually, I took my favorite one and my graphic designer took her favorite one, and we combined those two together with an illustrator, and it kind of creates this interlacing type of fluid border of a fusion. Mm-hmm. And the illustrator just created one, and then he copied and pasted each and every single one. I said, no, I don't like that. It's not good enough, because I want it to figure eight so that when it one side is above the other side, I want the next time to be the exact opposite so that it is below the other side the next time you see it. So it's creating this interlaced figure eight, three-dimensional interlaced figure eight. And he said, Ralph, no one's going to notice that. It'll cost you more money to do this. Let's just move on. And I said, no, I will notice that. I will lose sleep over this. You have to do this for me so that I'm okay with this.
So obviously you're a highly visual creature and you have very specific vision in mind. But I can't help but think that in addition to the aesthetics, which are formidable, there must be some corollary, some relational element to the wine that you make and how you want to present it. Is there something about the integrity of the product that you also want to showcase the moment people lay out in your bottle?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the label will get your attention. It'll get your foot in the door. It'll pique people's interest. But I source fruit from the most ultra-premium terroir in Napa. From Pritchard Hill, Howell Mountain, Oakville, Atlas Peak, Coombsville, just some of the best fruit in Napa Valley. For instance, in 2015, after being on a wait list for about 5 years, I got fruit right next door to Harlan. There's this vineyard right between Harlan and Bond. And I waited, I thought I'd never get this fruit. 1 year I got this fruit, and I was absolutely ecstatic. And I told everyone about it, stupidly. Looking back, it was stupid. I told everyone about it. I should have kept my damn mouth shut.
Well, it's not a secret now. I told in the beginning of the podcast that we were revealing secrets. Your secret number one that you just disclosed.
Well, it's not a secret anymore, because the following year I got bought out for three times what I paid for.
Oh, my God.
So I realized then and there I have to protect my investments. I have to guard it with my life, really, because when I first started this venture in 2013, it was relatively easy. I wouldn't even say easy. It was easier to find premium fruit. And today, you can find good fruit, but to find ultra-premium fruit, it's very, very difficult. There's been a huge boom in Napa Valley around in 2013. There were about 450 wineries in Napa Valley, and today there's about 900.
900.
So almost, yeah. It's doubled, and a lot of these wineries that have emerged are purely for vanity purposes. There's a lot of celebrities. Danica Patrick's my next door neighbor on the slopes of Howell Mountain with Somnium. I don't know if you know that brand.
I have read about it.
Aaron Pott makes that wine.
Yeah.
A lot of celebrities are in the Valley now. Mm-hmm. So you have John Legend, you have race car drivers, singers, actors, athletes, you name it.
The Valley hasn't expanded, but the massive infusion of capital seems to have.
Exactly right. And Napa Valley is only 9% planted vineyards. 9%. Everyone acts like it's 200%, right? Measure C, for instance, last year, everyone was complaining about that, and I was very much against it because as a small winery like myself, I only make 1,000 cases of wine a year, very boutique. If Measure C had passed, you're landlocking Napa even further, so you're preventing more of a expansion of in an agricultural area where it should be agricultural and it shouldn't be parking lots and Targets and things like that. It should all pretty much be vineyards, in my opinion.
Right. You would take heart in the fact that some very smart people that we just had this conversation recently that's been farming Napa Valley for decades and that are extremely invested feel the same way, is that if this is not truly the agricultural area, then it will turn into an urbanized environment, which I don't think any of us really want. If we think about it, even people that are remote should realize that this is a treasure and it should be protected as agricultural treasure.
Absolutely. And people were trying to create a solution to a problem that didn't exist. And my neighbor above the hill, Randy Dunn, I respect him, legend, you know, but he was on the other side of that.
Was he protecting his own interests?
He's a huge environmentalist, which I respect. I'm also an environmentalist, but I'm also making wines in Napa Valley. And had that passed, it would probably have priced me out, to be quite honest. For a small producer like myself, you would have seen a skyrocket in grapes. You would have seen a skyrocket in the pricing of wines, which I already think is... I hear all the time that it's a problem to many consumers. They can't afford Napa Valley. They go elsewhere in California because of that. I read an article in Wine Spectator. James Lobby wrote about that, talking about how overinflated Napa Valley prices have become. He has a great point about that. I just feel like, as a small producer, I want to be able to give you luxury, but not at an exorbitant amount. So I like to underpromise, overdeliver, give you very high-end branding and luxury and quality with that ultra premium terroir, so that when you smell the wines, you get that wine underneath your nose and you experience it on your palate. The first thing you say is, wow, my mind is blown.
Let's talk about this for a second, because I think it's a really important point to make. What you're describing in essence is a value proposition. You, like you said, you want to over-deliver. You want to produce as much as possible for and keep the cost down as much as possible as well. However, the economic reality is that Napa Valley is a very expensive place to farm. So there's labor costs, there's ensuing fruit costs. It's a very competitive environment that you just very articulately described. So for a small producer like you, you really are beholden to certain factors you cannot manipulate in any way. So in order for you to produce the final representation of your vision, you have to take this into consideration. And your bottles are not priced arbitrarily. It's not because, you know, you want to collect X amount of money, correct?
Mostly correct, yes.
Mostly correct. Okay, come on. let's hear the point I'm
making. You're absolutely right. The land costs here are outrageous. When I first got into this, land prices were around $100,000 an acre, mm-hmm. roughly, planted vineyards. Mm-hmm. And today you can expect that to be three times what that was 5-6 years ago.
It's a very short amount of time, by the way. Let's think about it.
It's a boom. I mean,
it's basically meteoric rise.
My next door neighbor is Google money. And the guy who I bought the vineyard from was the inventor of the aluminum baseball bat for Easton. So it's a lot of elitism in Napa Valley, which is great, but it's also a double-edged sword because they have the money that grows on trees. Whereas for me, I'm all in, and this is my bread and butter. This is all I do, and that's why, I mean, it's my passion, is really what it is.
You chose to play in a high High stakes. Yes. So you've made your bed there. And I mean, I'm sitting here with a bit of admiration, almost, you know, for you having the guts to go there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Because this, you know, it sounds all fine and good, but you have to actually make it happen in every level and compete with something that's frankly, you know, like you said, it's almost impossible to compete with somebody who doesn't need to make money and have all the resources in the world.
I appreciate you saying that. When I asked my parents if they wanted to be involved, I asked my dad, I told him my business plan, I gave him my proposition to see if he wanted to be a partner, an investor or whatnot. And he declined. He said, first of all, I think doing Hurdle Lendy is a big mistake. It's a very hard last name to learn for the average consumer. Why don't you choose one of your ancestors' names, such as Hitt, H-I-T-T. You can run with that marketing-wise. You can call it a big hit, whatnot. I said, I hear you. However, I'm not passionate about Hitt. It's not my last name. Hurdle Lendy is what I'm very passionate about. And I asked my dad, have you ever heard of a guy named Arnold Schwarzenegger?
That's a good one. Yes, I love that you're so impassioned about it. And following that, I think number one rule in life and in business, I think it shows in your work if you're really not into it yourself. I want to continue this conversation, but I want to go back for a second because I'm picturing in my mind a kid that was raised, you know, Berkeley is a pretty liberal environment. For you to be sent to boarding school, which I've never been to one, but I assume it's pretty restrictive, that had to have been an adjustment, and I want to hear all about that.
Well, I went to three different high schools and three different colleges by choice, not because I was kicked out or anything like that. I was never the most amazing student, but I always had my fortes here and there. So musically or my interests were not really always what the SAT would showcase. You know? So if there was a fermentation school when I was 15, I would have excelled at that. If I lived in Germany, for example, I'd probably be a master brewer right now. And I probably would have left school because I would have picked up a trade or an apprenticeship and gone down that road. But my parents were like, we want you to go to Ivy League schools. And I said, I don't want that. That's not what I want. But it didn't matter what I wanted. It was what they wanted. So they always had really high expectations of me. And I was never that A student that excelled at everything. I grew up with a learning disability. I'm part dyslexic. So they say it's mild, but I read a lot slower than most people. I have to read things multiple times to really fully retain it. But once I read it a couple times, I will remember it forever. So when I play the piano, for example, I was classically trained since I was 5. I can just play things that I remember because I had to overcompensate for that learning disability. It just gets locked in. And people say that it's pretty impressive that I can lock things in, compartmentalize everything and lock it in so that I can retain it permanently.
So you turned this challenge into an asset.
It was a lot of work, but yes. I went to a lot of tutoring and extra hours doing that stuff, and it was very frustrating because people would always sympathize, but they don't know what it's like going to these schools, very preppy schools, and being held to a very high standard. And you know, I felt like I didn't really quite always fit in, and I always really disliked school, to be quite honest. I actually, sophomore year of college, I told my dad, I'm like, I really just want to drop out. I don't want to do this. And he convinced me to stay in school, get my degree, which I got in business. But yeah, I think just life experience was what reformed me, I guess. Once I found my calling, everything just started to naturally come into place very easily.
When did that moment take place? You clearly had faced some formidable challenges as a kid. You know, we don't know exactly what's wrong. We just know something is wrong, you know, at a very early age. So it must have been such a difficult road. And I won't trivialize it by, you know, saying I'm very empathetic, but I think there's a huge lesson to be learned here, because you took, like I said, a challenge, and at some point there was that mental shift when you realized you're different, but different is different. Different is not an inferiority thing. And you somehow framed it very differently in your own mind. When did that happen? Was there a catalyst?
No, it's funny they say different is not inferiority, because I think I do have somewhat of an inferiority complex, and that's why I overcompensate with my work.
Yeah.
So that's why the labels are very regal and ornate. That's why my wines are always top tier, top class. I think it's because I grew up with a bit of a chip on my shoulder like that.
Mm-hmm.
Should we pause this for a second?
We're back with Ralph Hedelendi, and he was telling us about a disability that could have made his life very different than what it turned out to be. And that was a direct result of him actually taking control in some ways and framing his disability. So he's gonna tell us more about that.
Well, I learned about it in middle school. So I was in that tutorial class after school, and
yeah.
I had to work at it, and I got extra time on my exams. So I always felt different than everyone else, and because reading took me a lot longer than the average person, it was very frustrating. I still deal with it today. It's not like something that I overcame. It's something that I just know how to deal with it. I know how to live with it. It's really interesting too. There's this program there's an app on your phone where you can have it read 500 words a minute. All it does is it flashes a word, and I can actually read that fast when it's done that way. But reading left to right on a piece of paper or online, that takes me a very long time to do. It's mm-hmm. really, it's really interesting how that happens. So anyways, I was talking about how I've always felt different, and I always felt kind of like it was, it kind of gave me an inferiority complex, because I always struggled. I wasn't normal like
yeah.
everyone else. And having been raised with my mom being Chinese, growing up like that too, I always felt a little bit... And being multicultural as well, multi-ethnic, I never really felt like I truly fit in anywhere. So I was always a social butterfly. I always made a lot of friends, but I never really felt like I truly, like, fit in per se. So I just once I discovered I wanted to do wine, which, you know, I made my first vintage 13 years ago in my basement. Once I discovered that my real passion for wine, I started working for other wineries and just learning the ropes through experience. I knew that if I were to do it, it wouldn't be just generic wine. It had to be luxurious, high-end, because I'm a total wine snob and I want to just produce some of the most fantastic wines in the world.
So you mentioned beer, and somehow there's clearly wine present in your family, as you described. There were French wines that were shared at dinner table, so you had a taste of something that pleased you. And then you also learned somewhere along the way about your family's roots. So how did that all come together? Why wine?
It's a little more, well, I guess because it's in my DNA, really. I mean, my ancestors were doing it 300 years ago. And to be quite honest, I made pretty crappy beer. my beer was horrendous. There's a place called the Oak Barrel in Berkeley where they'll sell you all the equipment, so the hops, the yeast, the barley. You can sell that to a 15-year-old kid. It's not illegal. And when I went there, I said, which combination can produce the highest amount of alcohol? And they said, oh, this Bavarian lager, 8.4% alcohol. So I made it with my brother, Glenn, who, it took us about 6 weeks to produce this German-style lager, and I thought it was going to be delicious. It was very dark, it was very high alcohol, and it tasted like crap. So I was actually going to toss it all away, and my brother said, you've already bottled it, you might as well not throw it away, but do something with it. You're a freshman in a new high school. Why don't you make some new friends? And so one night I threw a party, and I remember the upperclassmen who used to kind of bully me before that, they said, I self-consciously asked them, what do you think of this beer? It sucks, doesn't it? And they're like, bro, this is the best beer I've ever had in my life. Two beers and I'm wasted. So I made a lot of friends. They never bullied me after that. And I saw how alcohol brought people together. And I think some romantic relationships occurred from that evening, boyfriend, girlfriend. So I always loved how libations brought people together.
And so that was your first discovery, that's a glue.
I saw it with my parents throwing dinner tables, but that was the first time that I had a real personal connection to it.
Yeah.
And then 10 years later, I started making wine, mostly as a hobby, but I was always fascinated with the process. So I did stomp on those grapes, and I was reading a lot of books. I was trying things that I probably shouldn't have been doing, but for my first vintage, I'm like, I'll try this. I'll try doing a carbonic maceration on this. Why not? I'm reading about it. Why not try it? I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea that your wine is only as good as your grapes. So I figured, oh, if I buy just regular grapes from Napa, it's got to be good. It ended up being very herbaceous, very green. Like green bell pepper was not good at all. I learned a lot that year. And then the more vintages under my belt, the more I realized it really depends. Your wine is only as good as your grapes.
Where was that alchemism come from? Where was that desire to experiment and, try and fail?
Well, I never think about failing. I just want to just try new things all the time. So, and I'm not a bad cook, for example. I love to cook. I love to use a lot of ingredients and not just the generic salt and pepper. I like finding spices that you can create these amazing combinations. And lately I've been getting into Thai spices and Indian spices and things that you don't find every day. And for instance, when I make chicken, I'll buy one of those family packs and I'll cook it all at once, but I'll make two of them curry, two of them garam masala, two of them rosemary chicken, and then I'll eat it throughout the week, and it keeps things interesting. But I like to mix and match, and I do the same thing with wine. So I'll sprinkle a little bit of Howell Mountain here, a little bit of Oakville. I trademarked Rockwell Ridge for my vineyard, and I have yet to put it on my label because to vineyard designate, you have to have 95%. And I always find that blending Pritchard Hill or Atlas Peak or Oakville fruit with my vineyard, it always enhances the flavor. It always makes it better. So to this day, I've yet to use that vineyard designate on a label. But it's there just in case one vintage I want to do that.
That's really smart. And it's kind of common rhetoric in the wine world that winemakers spice rack is, of course, there's vineyard sources, but there's also what they do in the cellar and such like that. I just want to go back for the listener, if you hadn't zeroed in on this comment, the chefy part of you, I thought that was really interesting, because how many of us go to Costco over the weekend and buy stuff for the week and throw it in the freezer? This is actually a really practical tip. Take your chicken and make different recipes with it. This is totally off subject, but as a home cook myself, I think you just maybe accidentally or purposefully offered some sage advice. So I just don't want to gloss over that.
And when I buy my ingredients, avocados, for instance, I'll buy I'll buy maybe like four avocados at a time, and one of them will be ripe today. Two of them will be somewhere between ripe and underripe, and the last one will be completely underripe. So that throughout the week, when I'm enjoying it, they will ripen perfectly throughout the week. Otherwise, everyone just gets what's ripe today, and then they have all this produce that expires within a couple days. I try to really pre-plan my weeks like that.
You know, that's really smart, and it shows your practical side too, because, you know, winemaking is also about practicality. We always talk about the romance and the flavor profiles and the ratings and whatnot.
Let me tell you about the romance.
It's a big piece of it. I mean, let's face it, grapevines are unlike anything else, and the wine experientially is unlike any other beverage. So romance is valid. But again, there's a lot of practical parts, and I'm loving how that side of you shows up, certainly in the kitchen, and I'm sure that we're going to be talking about how it shows up in the cellar. But, you know, the whole wine and food connection, and being European, and you mentioned dinner parties, you know, in your home, there's that culture that goes hand in hand, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they have to. One thing I don't like, though, is how people will ask, what should I eat with this wine? Because it's so ingrained in our heads that food and wine pairing are such a thing that you have to have specific types of food with specific types of wines. Yes, sometimes it works perfectly that way, but I produce wines where you don't need any food. You can just enjoy my wines the way they are. If you want to pair off my Cabernet Sauvignon with a tomahawk steak, by all means, go for it. But you don't need that. You don't need to wait until you get that red meat to enjoy my wines. And a lot of wines can be produced where you do need food. I know that when you have old world style wines, many times you'll find that the food will enhance the flavors, most certainly. But
I'm, in case you guys can't hear, we'll do it again. I'm just clinking, Ralph, here, because this is so darn refreshing. We have become obsessed with food and wine pairing in the restaurant level, and it's a little bit sad to me, because wine is being used as a crutch when it should be very much its own entity that doesn't need a supporting cast. And by that I mean need, that you cannot consume it and have pleasure unless you have a plate of food in front of you. So thank you for making that point.
Well, I went to a very famous Michelin-rated restaurant, three-star Michelin-rated restaurant, and I had them taste my wines somewhat recently, and they said, these wines are very well made, we love them, but we're not going to put it on our list because your wines would actually overpower our cuisine, and we want very light wines, very light to medium-bodied wines, less bold, and that way our food will rise above the wines, and the wines will be kind of a side memory instead. And I, as a winemaker, I respected that opinion, and I really respected the candor, but in my mind, I want everything to be just like firing on all cylinders. I want the wine to be just as good as the food. And
So let's translate that to the consumer. Because I'm a little bit disturbed. Thank you for sharing that story. And obviously, we're not naming names. But at that level, at three Michelin stars, I would expect a very different mentality. I would hope that it would be harmonious. And
their cuisine is very light to begin with. So okay. I think that had a lot to do with it. And
okay.
And I really respected the fact. Usually, they say, thank you very much, and you're on your way. And they don't give you an answer.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of... It's like playing a game of poker. You're always constantly trying to read their tells while they're trying it. So there are people who will show no emotions, but you can tell by the way they look and the way their eyebrows move that they absolutely love the wines. And whatever excuse they come up with for not wanting to pick it up, that's on them. But I'll just tell them, hey, my wines are in the French Laundry, so if you don't think it's good enough, maybe you should tell them too.
For you, how did you learn to be such an active listener and observer? I mean, you just described a very sophisticated technique. I think they use it like for interrogation and profiles and such like that. This is not something that most people practice.
I'm just very observant. As you can tell by my labels, I notice very small details. So my sister tells me all the time, I can't believe you see all these famous celebrities in LA, because I'm always looking up and she's always looking at her feet when she's walking down the street. She's always looking down, and I'm always wanting to know what's around me and what I'm dealing with. So yes, I'm very observant, to your point.
Well, that certainly adds yet another quiver to you, you know, an arrow to your quiver, because winemaking also is a lot about observation, very astutely studying the vineyard and, you know, in your cellar practice is what the wine is doing. So I think that's an asset. I find it absolutely fascinating that you started a brand, and obviously you were describing some marketing efforts, such as meeting with restaurateurs and wine directors. But you started a brand with a what seems like a very specific vision of where you wanted to wind up. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I want to be known as one of the top producers in the world, not just in Napa. I want to be known as like the Petrus of Napa Valley, just very small boutique. Only the people who know about me will know, and it's never going to be a household name that you discover at a grocery store, supermarket. It's something that if you want it, you will have to actually go take a little effort and seek it out yourself.
It's ambitious, and there's a formidable practical side to it. So let's start with, what did that ambition come from? Where did that idea come from for premium or ultra premium, as you're describing, brand?
My inferiority complex.
All ties together.
I don't know. I've always loved really nice things growing up. I remember growing up when I was 16, I loved wearing cologne. I think I might have been the only guy wearing cologne in high school. It was not common. And the term metrosexual didn't really come out until the early 2000s. But I think I've always kind of been a little bit of that nature. I've always loved really nice things growing up. And things that were just good enough or okay, I found to be rather blasé. And things that were really nice were some things that I gravitated towards and said, okay, now we're talking. You know, it doesn't matter if it's cars, Ferraris, Aston Martins, or if it's luxury whatnots, you name it. I've always loved that.
How did you give yourself permission to pursue it? I mean, a lot of us have champagne taste and a beer wage, and a lot of us dream about, you know, those sorts of things. Nobody would actually kick luxury off the table if you asked them. But achieving it is a whole other ballgame. And how is it that you mentally made that choice that I'm not only into it, I'm going to pursue it?
I think that it was a very long process. It's not like I woke up one day and said, you know what, I'm going to just go into this luxury brand. I started making just generic wine and realized I didn't like it and it wasn't good enough. And then I had a real aha moment around 2008 or so, or 2009, somewhere in there, where I was at Del Dado and I tasted their 2007 Lot B2 Cabernet Sauvignon. And it absolutely blew my mind. It was an accidental blend where they had Pritchard Hill fruit with their, I believe, St. Helena Mountain fruit. And that half that fruit was from Bryant family, where they were sourcing from back then, before they got their own Villa del Lago property out there. Mm-hmm. So they produced, I saw how blending the vodka with the more Mayacama side, both sides of the valley, combined into one, it created a very mind-bending aha moment for me. And I never knew wine could be that good. And I thought to myself, this is really something special. And I loved it so much, I ended up working at Del Dado.
You did.
About like 3 or 4 years after that experience. But I had already worked at Casey Flat Ranch prior to that. And I studied with the Guild of Sommeliers, and I realized I wanted to be more in production, less in serving. I just really worked from the ground up, but it was all a process. And I thought to myself, as I was really getting immersed in that world and trying as much wines as I possibly could, I would try to find one specific terroir and really immerse myself in that terroir to really understand it. So Pritchard Hill, for instance, I'm like, okay, I'm going to check out Ovid, David Arthur, mm-hmm. Montagne. I want to taste everyone up there. And then a month or two would go by, and then I'd be like, okay, I really want to get to know Oakville now. And then I would taste everyone there to really get a great sense of the terroir, the soil, and also it's really interesting to see how different a wine can taste from one vintage to the next as well within that terroir.
Yeah.
So, and anyone can make a great wine on a great vintage in Napa. I mean, you'd have to be a really bad winemaker to screw that up, but like 2011, for instance, we had some of the most rain in over 30 years. It was a very wet year, very underripe year. That's when you discover who the good winemakers are.
Yeah, and actually this comes up in conversations quite often, and I just want to highlight once more. 2011 was largely panned by the critics, and that's the tragedy of my profession, when journalism gets in the way of true stories. And the true story of the vintage is exactly as Ralph just described. It was a very challenging vintage, I dare say, old world-like. They have lots of those. Yet, winemakers that are true to their craft has made some of the best wines, some of the most elegant and cellar-worthy wines I can think of.
So, to your point, during that time frame when I was tasting through a lot of 2011s, I found that Calistoga had made the best 2011 vintages because it gets hottest up there. So you had the ripest fruit of that vintage up in Calistoga. And I avoided 2011, and I started tasting it about a year ago or so, and now they've finally started to come around. They're starting to get presentable and good. Some are actually pretty good, but if you were to take a 13 versus an 11, or even a 16 versus an 11, it's a night and day difference that you can see if you do it side by side. If you do it blind, you'll be like, this is a really easy. You'll be able to know which vintage you like better very easily.
It's not an instant gratification vintage at all.
No.
And as you correctly point out, Napa is all about microclimates. For that matter, any wine region is. So what happened in Calistoga does not mimic Oakville or Central Coast to Paso Robles or Anderson Valley. So to pan a whole vintage on the basis of one snapshot kind of blows my mind a little. I'm almost embarrassed on behalf of, you know, certain publication that chose to do it. Because it didn't do any service to the trade community or the consumer community, for that matter. I urge you to please, if you're into wine at any level, especially if you have a cellar and you're seeking the type of wines that would reward you with a lot of largesse down the line, please buy 11s from your favorite producers. Did you make wine in 11?
I skipped that vintage.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that before we leave that subject. But I understand that, you know, it's probably a marketing decision. It's not a decision that's product, you know, and it's very pure form driven. But you clearly are very honest about your craft, and I truly appreciate that.
Thank you.
We will continue this discussion shortly. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.